Just beyond the purview of this radiophonic broadcast signal, which has been extended for today's program.
Extended for today's program.
Lies an unincorporated town of indeterminate dimensions and ill-defined composition, which itself exists as an affront to reality. The town, whose name is best left to chance, consists of a single street, for better plots, which, when viewed from below, appears to extend perpendicular to itself to a point visible primarily in the red light spectrum. When viewed from above, the street disappears altogether. While devoid of sentient life, Verblätterplatz.
Ah, I thought it was like Verblätter and Verwullersplatz.
This may reveal itself at a later point in the story.
Continue, wie von these Platzes.
Verblätterplatz nevertheless supports a booming paramutual system of government, whose laws apply to only one side of the street, which is incorporated. The sole manhole cover in the street. No. The embossed lettering on the sole manhole cover in the street, that is, when viewed from below, is the spittooning image of the Bingen's company. This is just difficult.
Would you like me to read it today?
I'll just get through. I have to concentrate on the words. They're not familiar to me.
Concentrate.
Is the spittooning image of the Bingen's company corporate seal a fact of no other significance? Go ahead. Yes. The administrators of the street who dispense currency, and the bureaucrats who continually rewrite the laws governing its disposal, resemble red spectrum bacteria in size and demeanor. Reasonable discussions between the many political factions can best be described as chaotic. Cue cassette.
Помню.
Особенно.
Судьба. Синий.
Four times a year, when the sun rises from the north and sets at an angle of 23.5 degrees longitude, Verblätterplatz appears to the casual onlooker to spin on its axis, thereby refuting the laws of physics, gravity, and traffic.
Магазин.
Соединитель.
Композитор.
Радио трансмиссии, such as this one, get sucked into the resultant equinoxic vortex, draining most of the life out of the broadcastic waves and any ancillary radiophonical hosts.
Взять. Разговаривать.
Подпись.
Хозяин. Остановиться.
A black hole appears, both in the time-space continuum and in a dank, ivied ghetto in southernmost Calcutta, whence distorted nuclei gamble to freedom, further contradicting basic scientific principles of motion. Due to the arrival of the whole's harmonic convergence, the unincorporated side of Verblätterplatz is sponge-bathed in darkness. The attention spans of chemical reactions are temporarily suspended. Zippers malfunction, pole beans grow mustaches, celestial mechanics from the Andromedan body shop are laid off in droves, and the Bimbingen Company corporate seal appears in a dream simultaneously to thousands of left-handed kegglers. chaos
Нечто
reigns.
Женского рода сделала что-то по отношению к существу мужского рода.
Андрей Николаевич,
ведь это правильно.
У нас будут завтра занятия.
Fortunately, this equinoxic counterflux does not last long. Within minutes. Within minutes of its onset, gravitational traffic begins to move normally. Mechanics are rehired. Zippers again slide smoothly on their tracks. The Bibingen name fades from memory, just as the enigmatic Le Flambeau Orient returns to haunt one and all, and the sun falls back into the sea. On the unincorporated side of the street, it is a time for that frank discussion of cassava and cantaloupe known as the Verblätterplatz melodrama. It is a time to celebrate a return to symmetry and coherence, though not necessarily in that order, and certainly not during the next 2 hours, a time reserved for Calvos and Damien's new music bazaar, which, since it lies somewhere between the cusps of order and disorder, make this 109th episode bicuspid in the best sense of the word. For better or for worse, as you already surmise.
For better or for worse.
Then we shall on this radio program attempt to pick the musical pockets of celestial zippers and spittooning Calcuttans, of perpendicular realities and red light bureaucrats, of attentive mustaches and gambling manholes, all the while seeding the minds of our listening audience with an alternative reality of sound, gravity, and traffic. So keep those hands and ears where we can see them. Calvos has you covered.
He does. What was that?
What
traffic?
Was that? Somewhere in there.
Comedy?
No, gravity. And it's,
gravity?
And it's sun comedy.
Levity? Traffic?
Travity.
Travity. Travity.
Hmm.
In the background, soon to be in the foreground, is the music of Erling Vold from a CD called I Weep. This is the conclusion of The Egg. We'll be back with more new releases, news of the internet, and an interview conclusion with Elma Estonia Miller.
With which will be yokeless.
from I Weep by Erling Vold.
You want to read the liner notes to Egg?
Egg.
Egg.
I will take this. This is a very interesting cover. It looks like it was done on an Atari from maybe 1982 or so. The liner notes on Egg.
There may not be any.
Well, I'm sure there is. It says it's one of a series of dances I did with Gay White and Lee Evans, along with Crash and Hagalaz, which appear on my Music of Love CD. That's this one. This is the pair, I should say. Music of Love. The original solo Shakuhachi piece is from a tape of unknown origin and vintage. A lot of that going around, you know.
Yeah. When they don't want to give credit.
Credit, exactly. The sounds which appear with the flute were created either by I wonder if he knows. Either by processing the original flute sound or by sampling bits of percussion, tapes, and junk on the Synclavier digital synthesizer. The tuning is a 5-limit pentatonic as opposed to a 6-limit pentatonic. Well, never mind. Derived from the original tape with the addition of some parallel 3-2s, 4-3s, and 8-5s.
Huh.
Is that revealing?
Sure is.
Okay, well, let's reveal some more. Since today is the birthday of Willie Moscone, the super ivory bumper stick pong player.
Billiardicist.
Billiardicist. Yes. I thought we would jump around in our new releases to pieces of remarkably different characteristics as we go from one to the next. Sort of an incoherency of sound, but a coherency of direction.
This is different from any other program?
Absolutely.
Oh, good!
In this particular case, we are adding the component of direction.
Direction.
As opposed to stasis.
Direct away.
Yes. Just received a compact disc called Antiphony, or Antiphony, if you like antimony.
Certainly.
And nickel. This is a UK release, which we managed to secure. And there's a composer by the name of Zbigniew Karkowski, who I've mentioned on this program before as a guy who said he would be heard more than Mozart ever could have, because with his equipment, his friend and the compact disc, he could be heard anywhere in the world by tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. And he's true, because we're about to play one of his pieces. And this is Zbigniew Karkowski and Eric Lyon, and this is from the new CD Antiphony, and the piece is called something or other. No, it's not called anything. It doesn't have a name. It's just them doing stuff. Here it is.
Thank you.
Eat your heart out, Wolfgang.
Right. The tune sort of gets in your head and it's hard to get out.
That's right. That's the opening, at least, by Zbigniew Karkowski and Eric Lyon of an untitled piece on Antiphony.
And you say they used to record under a different name.
Oh, yeah. It was called Hafler Trio, Two Guys and Their Electronics. And you can read all about it on the website, www.maltedmedia.com. Go to the books and papers section and read an essay called, I don't remember what it's called. We kind of call it head bore to ourselves, but it's...
It was lengthier.
Yeah, something about process technique or something. I don't remember exactly what, but look for that, and you'll find a whole rundown of Karkowski and his quotes. And while we'll let this go here, speaking of the Internet, we have just uploaded 22 Calvos and Damien programs complete to AudioNet, which should be available in a day or two for your listening pleasure. So if you've missed any past shows, you can click right on our webpage, the AudioNet Jump, and you can hear the interview with Eve Baglarian or Udo Kasemets, or you can hear the opera that was done here with the students of Suleim Tan. You can hear the interview with Eric Hagen, or Clarence Barlow, Richard St. Clair, Maria de Alviar, Rhys Chatham, Marc Battier, Kaya Sarriaho, and Pauline Oliveros. We'll have many more interviews, shows up, and ready to listen to within the next month or so, but the first 22 shows will be available next week. Right now, March 15th and March 22nd are currently posted, and those didn't have guests, but those were kind of our test shows. So, go on to the old Calvus and Damien page, www.maltedmedia.com. That's like malted milk, and if you're listening on the Internet already, you know how to do that, because you're there.
Unless this is some time-space continuum jump, and they reached this through some other means.
So let's do our rubber bumper ping-pong billiardification onto another piece by Matt Turner, who is a composer and cellist, and this is from... And chef, perhaps chef, the Turner Chef Organization, the Turner Chef Network. This is from CD called Infiltrator with Matt Turner on cello and piano. I guess he uses that technology, or he's got a really interesting build. This is a piece called My Red Hat. Billiard cue on cello by Matt Turner.
I thought the piano part was very laid back in that.
It's not clear from the indexing here exactly what pieces the piano is on.
I see.
And because I am a very thorough listener to each piece ahead of time, shall we say, 5 seconds at the outset and 5 seconds at the conclusion.
Yes.
That's when I'm in a good mood.
Right.
I wasn't sure that we might not get some piano in there eventually. Anyway, somewhere in there from Infiltrator by Matt Turner. That's my red hat. And let's go to another rubber bumper, leather bumper on the felt.
Now, do we know this next guy? Do we have...
No, not at all. We have done our usual auditioning technique, which is... approximately 1% of the composition. This is Sidney Davis. This is Star Axis from a CD, The Aerial Number 5. It comes out of Santa Fe. It's kind of a CD publication.
Right, but we do reserve the right to withdraw the selection at any time if we find it ill-fitting.
We always reserve that right. That's one of the great pleasures of having the buttons and the switches. Here it is. We'll be back just after the top of the hour with our interview with Elma Miller. Here it is, Star Axis by Sidney Davis.
Several years ago, before the advent of cable television, there appeared on network television a program called The Gong Show.
Is it that time?
that little desk clerk bell keeps chiming away and making me think that
it's time for the big old gong.
The big old gong. Just I'm looking
for those marbles being clicked together. It sounds like marbles. I think they're supposed to be carried away by the clicking of the marbles.
Is that it? All right.
Either that or it's cue balls. Maybe it's Willie Moscone.
Oh, Star Axis, let's see. 80 miles southeast of Santa Fe, artist Charles Ross is constructing an earthwork project called Star Axis. A giant cousin to the sundial, it is visual manifestation of the astronomical event called the Great Year, or the Precession. Star Axis will measure the wobble in the Earth's orbit in relationship to the North Star as it proceeds through this 26,000-year cycle. In the works for 14 years, Star Axis is near completion. The music heard here was inspired by a visit to the site. For 3 days and nights, I recorded every sound I could capture. This has been a marbles tournament?
Marbles tournament.
Then I went into the studio and created the piece using those materials. The underlying sound was made by the 100-foot-long strings used as guy wires in constructing the sculpture.
Good.
Which resonated when the wind reached a particular velocity. Good. This sound, plus the column harmonies, which were also a result of wind resonance, were used to create musical loops. In parallel to these loops is the sound of rocks from the site rattling inside a Tibetan prayer bowl.
Rocks in a Tibetan prayer bowl.
Which
All
is
right.
then struck with a wooden stick.
Where did that piano come from?
These rhythmic sounds and resonance loops represent the sounds of the earth and sky meeting. Riding on top of them is an acoustic piano improvisation. The voice of space.
There it is.
Sky wires, rocks, and space.
All for Star Axis by Sidney Davis.
Not that we're judging this piece.
No, we wouldn't want any judgments to come out of our mouths during the new powerful throat of WGDR Plainfield.
Now heard in your community.
In your community. As far away as Granville, Waterbury.
Or the internet.
Or the internet. And of course on and welcome again to WOMR in Provincetown. We have to keep saying that because we only have one other station who broadcasts this show.
And they're funding our work, are they not?
Oh, I would hope so. Why, they've sent us at least, I don't know, enough to buy a McDonald's burger.
Oh, there you go.
But that wouldn't be the correct thing to do.
Certainly not.
No. Let's go back to our interview with Elma Miller. Unfortunately, Elma was not able to get us a copy of One Small Candle.
Which she claims we have.
So we'll play from
the Angster Clarinet Method, our favorite.
Nah, we really will play a piece for trombone and marimba by Elma Miller called Le Phoenix. And then we'll bring in the interview there in Toronto just after that snowstorm. Ready for La Phoenix?
Oh, sure.
while we're listening to we're listening to the candle being lit, the snow is being shoveled
well,
or something.
Well, we had 25 centimeters on Sunday, Monday. Boy, that was...
Is that Celsius?
No, centimeters.
Yeah, Celsius.
Right.
Yeah.
Celsius. Right.
like that much.
That was the Light One Candle music by Elma Miller. Elma Miller, since it's such a you know, as you said, sort of old sounding, very very Anglo-Saxon kind of a name. What was it before it was Miller?
Well, I don't know how accurate, but my father, he's dead now, but he had told me ages ago that the name Miller, in its original spelling, M-I-L-L-E-R, has been in the family for about 600 years. And it came from the Danes who, just as they were on their marauding way up north through the Baltic, checked out this island and decided to stay. And if you look at the people's names and their appearance, especially my grandmother, I suppose, yeah, they have the long chin, really facial features of the Danes. I could be imagining it too, but that name has been there. My great grandfather's name was Miller. I have a land document where his name's on there, and it's just absolutely amazing to me.
Wow.
So I don't know what the real story is. Don't always tend to believe. We don't know our backgrounds that much. Estonians never really talked about it. And even now, kids don't know really what happened. World War II obliterated a lot. Many people are dead in Siberia, and they didn't really survive. There isn't really much of a family to talk about. But that name is so easy to spell, so easy to pronounce.
Really?
And I kept it, and people have never had any problems with that, except the first name. I get Elmo, Elmer, whatever.
Elmo.
But that's normal. But if I had to have a last name that was distinctly Estonian, it would have been a nightmare.
That's but it would have a certain cachet.
Maybe.
That's right. Yeah.
It would be always, I would be confined to continually spelling my name or having it converted into some new plasma pronunciation. My girlfriend has
Miller.
This is another good story, I suppose. My girlfriend and I were waiting for her the results of her driving test, and her last name is Kalasma. And they kept saying, Esther Kalasma, Kalasma, Kalasma. I thought, what a funny name. We both sat there thinking, God, when are they going to call your name? We sat there for about a half an hour, close to it, and I said, why don't you go up and ask? So she went up and said, we've been waiting for the K's. We've been calling it all over the place. Really? Yeah, Klasma. It was so funny. So after that, I thought that that's just some mixed blessing being called Miller.
You are, let's talk about your other activities, the music typography. And you did... You did hand inking of scores for a long time.
Oh,
and now you do
drawing the lines, everything, the works.
Yeah.
Well, that was my sort of second job. I didn't like teaching, although I taught that. My students are all now well-paid jobs in the States, editors and whatnot. But I studied, or I didn't study, I just liked it. I fell into it in a way. And enjoyed it. I liked being alone, working away, doing people's scores, doing parts. And I got a reputation for accepting the most unusually difficult scores, scores nobody wanted to touch, like Sarabji scores.
Oh, God, you did Sarabji scores.
64, you know, like 64 notes per measure, or 34 and a half to two, or stuff like that. And people would just say, huh, no way. And I took it on, and I talked to him, and he was just, he had to call me and gasped over the phone that there were no mistakes, maybe just that one note. And I thought, oh, yeah, I know the one you mean. Yeah, we talked about that.
Oh, you spoke to the eminent Sarabji, Leon Dudley himself.
That's right, yes, that's, yeah, right. Yeah, Leon Dudley, that's correct, yeah. Weird. Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, he was quite nice. Very short call. I told Paul Rappaport that, you know, I wasn't thinking to be enough impressed at the time. I was naive. I didn't realize who he was, but So Paulio, guess who called? Paul Rappaport is the musicologist who worked with me, with whom I argued every section for hours before I even started on it. Mm. We had to agree, especially, and we knew. And I had the composer's original, the original, like hand-made paper. Not many copyists have the luxury of actually working from the original. Mm-hmm. It's always a copy of the original, which I had too. But that was, I insisted on it because it was so poorly copied. So I actually handled the original. It was the only composer I've ever copied for with me handling the original, which is something you never let out of your hands, ever. Never mind World War III. Just don't leave the original out of your sight. Put it in the bank. But that was quite an incredible amount of work. That was a highlight. That actually made my reputation.
Really?
So that work came in. And when I went to computer, everybody was worried stiff, but I got the benefit of the doubt from the composers who had always worked with me, and they wanted their scores now all computerized. So I bought the equipment, agonized over it, and then became completely computerized.
What do you use? What software?
Score, IBM.
You use Score.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's the program where the publishers all like that program. So now they're my employers.
Mm-hmm.
And other composers are slow. Some of them have it, some of them don't. Some of them have the Macintosh, but I couldn't afford the machine at the time. So it's a combination of money and what did the publishers want and what was also practical in the long run. And I went with all those in mind, I bought an IBM type of machine. And ever since then, I've been using that program. And it's allowed me to do the most incredible things. My own orchestral scores are, well, they're in a shambles. But for other people, I usually have to send out parts from other composers. But in the most recent orchestral works that I've started to put onto the... It's the usual case. Like the mechanic's car is the worst clunker on a lot, right? So people assume that, oh, God, I'm just send off the disc. And I thought, I don't have it. What do you mean you don't? You just did so-and-so's score. I saw your parts. Wow! Yes, well, that was it. Yeah. Well, he paid for it. Who's going to pay me to do my own parts? Excuse me. And but for the recent, for Two Light, One Candle, now that's all hand done. And since there's been so much of a demand for the score and the parts, I've decided to spend the time, spend a year, and put that all into the computer, despite the graphics, despite the... it's just the accordion graphics are going to be difficult, but I'm getting there. It's something I've already learned to do. It's in my repertoire. It's just that I do more difficult things than some of the composers who assume that the computer can't do it. So they sometimes gear their scores to the computer, whereas since I use the computer and know what it can do, I don't care. I just do and write whatever I feel like it, and then figure out how am I going to notate this in the computer. So it looks exactly the same.
Mm-hmm. Does working on other people's scores provide you with a sort of maybe the missing piece that you don't have because you're not going to a lot of concerts? You said you weren't going to.
That's true. Sometimes, yeah, I also find it's interesting. You learn an awful lot about their own way of thinking. You see, I have to look at every single note that composer put in. And you start to come up with whether they're pianists, whether they know their orchestral instruments, despite their reputation, the mistakes they make. If I know them and I know they don't mind, I'd say, well, you know, these notes are not on the instrument. You might want to rethink this. Or, yes, the French horn up there, that's not a good idea. I respect what you're trying to do. The MIDI program probably does it. Oh, yeah, you did the MIDI. Oh, yeah. Yes, well, they do breathe. Yes, well, I don't think they would mind if you help them out there, and these would be and they would rethink it. Then sometimes I'd get some very interesting combinations in people's scores of orchestral instruments, and those I would borrow. If it's a good idea, steal it. That's what I might maintain it. And but you never improve upon another composer's score, even though you'd like to. But usually it's some ideas for orchestration or pacing. Notation, I think in Canadian scores in general, the composers are still working too hard on the standard notational practices from the middle of the century, and some things could be done easily in a different way. So I have had some composers come to me where, well, there was one composer in particular, not, I don't get this request frequently, but what he wanted was this effect, and can I do that or can I help him out? So I designed the graphical score for him for 3 pages, invented a few notation symbols as I was going along, gave it to him for proofing, and then mapped it out in pen and pencil and told him this is what we're going to do. He ended up changing the music, and so he now, you know, wonder where's the copyright and where did I get my inspiration? Well, I don't know. I read a lot of notation books, and I'm the resource person for when people get stuck. So I give them ideas based on other scores. Or, you know, Baird did it that way. Don't you think that's still valid? Oh, he did, where? You know, and I would say where. And, oh, really? Huh. And, or Berio did it that way. What about trying that effect? Or, you know, did you look at Kegel's X? No, it's, well, that was an interesting effect, and it still works, so try it. Or, you know, or I think this will work here if you put the conductor going on and then off, and then tell them to play that in a certain amount of time, then how to get that other instrument in. It's very practical. It's just the way I explain mm-hmm. that. So that does show up in my scores, too. It's very practical. There's no time wasted in rehearsal. What does she mean? There's no such thing. There's no mistakes. It has to be there. And that's why I have these repeat customers who appreciate that and who know that their scores are up for grabs, although they'd be hard-pressed to find it in my score. But then that's how I get performances, too, I think, just out of the blue. People look at the score, they look at the great parts, they figure, sure, we'll try it. Okay. Besides, it's funny or it's a great name or I don't know.
It's funny or a great name. Let's hear another piece that has a great name. All your pieces funny. Have great names. What else? What do we have here to listen to? These things that we can't pronounce, for example, this piece for piano, 4 hands.
Oh, Synaedesis, that's great.
Synaedesis, okay.
Yes, I didn't bring the score. That's rather popular for some reason now, the score. yes, that performance, 2 phenomenal pianists, Elaine Keeler and Christina Petrowska.
Yes.
You can't ask for any. Well, of course, now there are really great pianists in Canada, but for that combination at that time, they were amazing, really amazing pianists.
Let's hear it. This is sit back, kick back, relax, because you won't through the music. Here it is, Synaedesis 12, music by Elma Miller.
Thank you.
Synodesis 12. I can say it now since you've said it. I looked at it the first time and I couldn't read the word.
Yeah, it's Greek. It's like Greek to me. Now, that's a profound loss I had when I was writing that of Robert Lungstedt. Did these huge woodcuts. I think I bought one of his last works. And he, when he died, he was a mentor to me. He's a great artist, was a prophet at Concordia for I don't know how many years. Great background of students. His wife, Anne Kahane, or Kahane, I don't know how to pronounce her last name, moved back to Montreal, where it was really more of a civilized atmosphere than Hamilton.
And civilized.
Oh, great. When I retire, I want to move to Montreal. Great restaurants, great atmosphere. The best performances of works I've had have been in Montreal. They're just crazy audience. Fantastic audience. Immediate response.
How do people find your music? I mean, how do they discover you?
Oh, it's... I don't know. And well, I had a reputation in Montreal ever since I... from about 20 years ago. I went there as a student with a university exchange and had a piece called Chick. I was the only woman coming out of U of T. No one believed that this three percussion work called Chick from where? U of T? U of T? You're sure? And they just said, unbelievable. How could, since U of T humor? Give me a break. It never would have happened. Oh, it's who? Elma Miller. Oh, gotta hear this. Chick. U of T. And it was over and over. Like, I had no idea what a reputation U of T had until I went to Montreal and heard everybody. And, of course, I can understand when I heard the rest of the composers that were in our contingent. I don't know why I never thought of it. There they were. I was like, boring. And then there was Chick. They didn't know what to think of it. I had the most incredible composers pumping my hand at the end saying, that was weird or funny or great. And the audience is all there. They couldn't believe it, this U of T composer. And ever since then, I think I've had very good performances. It's just based on this sort of an idea that they have or something they remember, and people still remember that. Student piece. It was pretty funny. Twit, chicka, twit, chicka, twit, chicka, boom, boom, chicky, chicky. I remember that. That was very funny.
What's the deal with the humor?
I don't know. I think I got... Maybe it was a reaction to what I was hearing. Maybe it was I felt like it. Maybe my instructor let me be me. Maybe I skipped a lot of composition classes I shouldn't have. I don't know where it comes from. I've been a rebel in that. I've done exactly always what I felt like doing. And I've heard all of my works. They've all been performed. There isn't really that many that are in the oeuvre that I haven't heard. And I don't know. The feedback from performers has been very positive or crazy, Alma. When are you writing another one? Or, I like this.
You don't seem to have a real, based on some of your notes, don't seem to have a real deep respect for the academic compositional world.
No, I made fun of it. Ever since I started writing music, I've made fun of it. Of course, and I'm a product of the academic world. There is the schizophrenic aspect of it. This love-hate, I suppose. Musicologists will have lots of fun over there. You've got to leave something for them, too, But it's, yes. But in order to write humor, it's very much like a stand-up comic. You have to know what is humor, why people laugh, how do people laugh, and what are you laughing at? Are you laughing at them? Ooh, no, not a good idea. Are you laughing at the audience, Or are you laughing at yourself? Or are you making fun of the whole aspect of a contemporary composer? What does that mean? You get composers side by side writing completely tonal works in a very... For instance, I'm going to name names. I hope I don't get into trouble.
Oh,
but
good.
Larisa Kuzmenko. The most recent work of hers was this fabulous piano concerto. And it got a really negative review, not because it was well written, Not because it was compositionally great and well-paced, put together beautifully, but because it was written in a style dating from 100 years ago or more. That's not good enough for me. I find that it was a good piece because if it worked, if it hung together, but just because it's just the tonal language, it's out of date. All of, you know, John Taverner, Kevin Bryars, Arvo Pärt, they could have been, look at Hildegard von Bingen, in style again. Unbelievable. I find it boring, but you know, oh, that. I can't stand it, but certainly respect good compositional technique. And I've always respected that. And that's why I make fun of it. It is so strong in people's heartfelt, what they like or what they hate, that it's so much fun to. Now we're going to go into our tonal mode. Fasten your seatbelts. And then now we're going to go out of it. Here's the fun part. Now everybody wake up. It's okay. That was only 3 seconds. And now we've got to have a build up. So you're going to be tonal here so we get everybody excited so I can end nicely. Now, do we have a fast ending, slow ending, high barn burner? You know, and that's the way they think. Young composers who come to me for the first time to get their parts, pieces copied. The first 2 pages, you look at their score, you think, all right, this is for a grand jury or a competition. So you've got to, you know, blow your bolt in the first 2 pages. And after that, you've heard this orchestral stuff. First 2 minutes, it's like everything in the entire arsenal. Then after that, it dribbles out to the end. Doesn't matter, they don't go that far. They don't look at it anyway. And I can't help but make fun. I can't help it. I see it. I don't think it exists, but there it is. Another score. And I think, oh, God. It's amazing. I can't help it. Write funny pieces. I look at the score. There you go again. Or how do you make a 20-minute commission last? Repeat. Repeat. Thank God for the computer.
Yeah, you right. Know? Cut and paste.
Yeah. Cut and paste. Sequencers. I mean, it's a blessing. And, I hear the same from Alcide Solanza. I hope I quote him correctly. But he was in Montreal, prof there at McGill. He sees this. He said, Elma, the worst thing that was ever invented was the sequencer. When you have an 8-minute piece, does anybody think of development? I mean, look at Francis Daumont's developments. Look at Alcide's scores and developments. Even his colleagues can't turn pages to read them. And it's amazing, but, you know, very rigorously written pieces. Solid. And then you get the other works that are, they run out of ideas at the 4-minute mark. It's an 8-minute commission. So far, they figure for 2 minutes, you know, just repeat a few things. Nobody will notice. Except when you do. Then it's like, right, the sequence just got turned on.
The copyist will notice.
Well, the copyist will notice, and it's a real pain. And when I do phone up, I say, well, there's a lot of repetition here. Would you like me to use repeat marks? Would that look good in the score? No. Just could you copy it? Do you mind? Fortunately, I had all these macros already signed up, and I could just repeat it all, because I assume that's what happened. Because it looks good in a score nowadays to have all the notes written out. You know, because some people are not score-oriented. They don't read the score. And any jury, you know, they just look at the first few pages, flip through, sometimes from the back, thinking, oh, God, I wonder what program he used. And that's it. That's it for the score. So if you write that way, you're going to sound that way. And, what can I say? You're hearing it on the radio. All the time. Some composers, you can tell they worked at it, but I do appreciate good compositional technique, whatever style it is.
What is the state of composition then today? I mean, where do you think the substance is right now? I mean, aside from your own.
I'm going to be biased here. But it's I'm more of a commentary on, in my own works, on the compositional state. That's where the humor comes in, the sarcasm. I find that composers are sometimes not honest. Sometimes they are, but we're not hearing them. They're not on the radio. They're not on concert programs. So it's dangerous being funny. It's dangerous being honest. You must give them what they want. As a good example, I'd like to bring up the most recent commission was the Seven Sisters Rising, for which you don't have a tape. It was a commission by the Windsor Symphony to seven composers from the conductor asking for a short 5-minute piece with a theme of mourning. So all seven composers had to write this orchestral work based on mourning. Now, that's a very specific commission. Not only do you get the time, you get the instruments, and it has to deal with mourning.
This is opposed to afternoon or late?
That's right. She wanted a piece that had the idea of a mourning on it. It's going to be on a mourning program, so what are you going to write? The rest is up to you. And can we have it in 3 weeks?
So you wrote a piece about a car.
No, I wrote Seven Sisters Rising.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's about the Pleiades, right?
That's right.
And that which
Subaru.
And Subaru is Pleiades.
Oh yes,
in
that's
Japanese.
Right. In Japanese,
yeah,
that's
car,
right.
You wrote
yeah,
a car
piece. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess you could put it that way. Yeah.
You see the Subaru on the lift being repaired.
Yes, in the score, that's the way you see it. Yeah. I mean, of course, if I was in Australia, I wouldn't see it that way. It would be on its side.
All right.
That's why I said rise.
Distracted for you from here.
That the state of composition is very much that. It's in a state of flux. There's a lot of cutbacks. People are turning to the more conservative, turning to the tried and true. And so a lot of scores are going to reflect that. Also, everyone now pretty well, I'd say 80% of the Canadian composers now have a computer program. So there's no excuse now to have lousy parts.
Mm-hmm.
So there should theoretically be a lot of performances. And looking at the Canadian Music Centre statistics, borrowing and lending is up. But we're not sure whether that's because they're on the Internet. That's another variable that
mm-hmm.
comes in there.
Mm-hmm.
And now, of course, you can just put in, well, my name on the computer at the Canadian Music Centre, type in Miller, and you'll either get Michael Miller or Elma Miller and all their works. Or you're looking for a flute, double bass, and banjo. You might not get that on the Internet because we work on the Library of Congress type of filing system. But you can send an email to the librarian at the Canadian Music Centre and they'll come up with the 5 pieces featuring that instrument or works with that instrument combination in there. And that's, again, the beauty of the Internet. I don't know how much that will impact on the style of writing. I doubt that. But I do think that, in general, there's this sense of conservative writing. I don't really believe the Toronto Symphony's conductors, Saraste, saying that the Canadian composers aren't up to par in the international scene. I don't agree with that. But I do believe that if you gave the Canadian composers a break and played a lot of them, different ones, across the country, long, short, I think the audience will give him a break, too.
Let's listen to one piece to play out the interview.
Right.
What's a good one?
Well, I like Circumstantial Evidence. Did I send you that?
Circumstantial Evidence, yes, we have that right here. That's good, yes.
It's,
And we are being joined by another composer right at this moment, so we're going to try and
speed things up.
Speed things up? No,
we have
one more piece about to happen, so let's get to it. And we thank you for joining us on the Calvos and Damien New Music Bazaar.
Oh,
gosh, we've been talking for more than an hour, and we still have more things to say, but we'll have to save it for next time.
Send me email.
Sure will. And you'll be able to listen to Ellen Miller's stuff on the Internet very soon, too, so that'll be wonderful. Circumstantial Evidence, and this is for what?
10 instruments.
10 instruments. Music by Ellen Miller. Thanks very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Circumstantial Evidence music by Elma Miller, ending quietly off in the distance with a single clarinet.
Oh, but you know there was a scherzo that follows, so you just didn't play it.
No scherzo. This was scherzy enough the way it was.
I suppose
that was
so.
Such a jolly, rollicking ending.
Mm-hmm.
I want more endings like that. That's modern.
Endings that you can find only over WGDR Plainfield.
The big voice.
The big voice of the valley. Yes, yes, yes. We can now be heard all over the place.
You betcha. Now what we have selected next is...
a compote of new tunes.
For our Willie Moscone bouncing off the rubbers.
Caroming first is Zoometry by Richard Power, a University of Illinois composer guy who did not study with the Brunsky. This is composed for Buchla 200 series synthesizer and the various sounds of animals. Zoometry.
Oh, Thank you.
There's a tasty billiard mix, biliously billiards, if ever I heard one.
Indeed. Boy, that was plenty billiardized. Well, releases we have recently received, and some interesting, some, we'll see. We started out with Zoometry by Richard Power. That's from a new compact disc called Wave Formation from the Experimental Music Studios of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Easily remembered?
Yes, the mnemonic is easily remembered. Exactly right.
Right. And then following that up, acquisition artist Laurel McDonald and her piece En Repine à la Ine. Little except from that lovely vocal work that she does. Very, very interesting. And then third we had from THD, a magazine very much in danger of being shut down because of lack of funding, published in Holland, THD. That was Yannis Kyriakides' Trace. And that essay we mentioned earlier, that headbore piece you can find on the Calvus and Damien site, also mentions the opinions of Yannis Kyriakides. And then recently deceased composer Toru Takemitsu and his Distance du Fait, played on the Onde Matino and piano from a Japanese release called Takashi Harada in the Garnet Garden. And then Kaya Sarriaho, not a recent release, but one we haven't heard yet, Io, from a collection of her music on Finlandia with the Avanti Chamber Orchestra. And following that, music played by Christina Petrovska, and that was Anne Southam's Rivers, Book 3, Number 8. I guess she's got a lot of rivers.
There's a lot of water up there in Toronto.
Must be. Then from the inevitable, I should probably say, music from Seamus, the Society for Electroacoustic Music in the United States, Volume 6, the new one for this year. That was Jeffrey Haas's Keyed Up for two amplified pianos and tape.
A production of Multimedia.